Hello, it's another episode of Sacktown Talks by the Nooner, What a Week, with Scott Lay, and I'm Jabron Maciel. This week, we covered a variety of topics as indicated in the show notes below. But first, let's pause for the cause. This episode is brought to you by the Nooner's Classified Ads. The California Gambling Control Commission seeks a Deputy Director of Legislation and Regulatory Affairs. UCLA Health is looking for an Associate Director of Government Relations, and that job is based in Los Angeles. The Center for Responsible Lending seeks a Policy and Governmental Affairs Associate for Oakland, California. And SEIU UHW is looking for a political coordinator that can be based in Oakland or Sacramento. SEIU UHW is also seeking regional political organizers for Los Angeles and San Francisco. The California Council on Science and Technology is hosting an expert briefing on the environmental impacts of wildfires in California on April 4th. And Women in Solid Waste is hosting a recycling networking event and panel discussion for April 2nd. Capitol Seminars. Learn how the Capitol really works from veteran lobbyist Ray Labov. Lobbying workshops April 4th and 5th. More information at capitalseminars.net. McKinley & Pelos Fundraising seeks an administrative assistant. And save the date, June 26th, 12th Annual Capitol Veteran of the Year Luncheon. Pruitt Consulting LLC seeks a part-time fundraising associate in Sacramento. And the Office of Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins is looking for a digital social media professional. Political Data Incorporated now offers online training on its newest software every week. That's just some of what you can find right now at aroundthecapitol.com/classifieds. Again, that's aroundthecapitol.com/classifieds.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Let's hey, get so crazy week.
What a week it's been.
Yeah, what a week, man. Politics, what we're here to talk about. We have on the outline here, and just so folks know, I think where we can expect to go before I start taking us off on tangents. The PPIC poll, general support of Newsom's priorities, concerns on housing affordability, death penalty, federal judge Roger Benitez's ruling on the gun magazine limit approved in Prop 63. I'm actually really interested in that.
It's a fascinating issue.
Yeah. Special elections, 2026, never too early. And Devin Nunes' $250 million lawsuit against Twitter over parody accounts.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have some fun with that.
And last check, he has something like 640,000 followers.
Yeah.
You know, the Devin Nunes cow. So we have a number of topics we're going to get to here, plus whatever curveballs we get to along the way. You want to get us going with the PPIC poll?
Yeah. So we had a poll come out on Thursday from the Public Policy Institute of California, which generally does a monthly poll. With occasional ones that are just general California and Californians and state government. And that's what we got on Thursday. And it found that, you know, people in California seem to be in a pretty good mood. They didn't ask the standard, what is your biggest priority of the legislature or what's the economic outlook? But if you look at the approval ratings of the governor and the legislature, they have been trending in a pretty narrow range for really since a few years after Jerry Brown came in, where the legislature went to a net positive, which is always a good thing for a legislature to have a net positive approval rating. And Gavin Newsom has started out with a pretty good approval rating. Californians still dislike President Trump. Okay, hate may be the word, unless you're including Republicans, and then it goes to dislike, because Republicans still are in the 70% range in support of President Trump and his priorities, but he is extremely disliked by Democrats and moderately disliked by independents. And as we know, with voter registration in California now, that means that you get a very low net positive approval rating for President Trump.
Can we pause on that? And just the numbers and how that informs the politics and I think some of the goofy stuff that we start seeing out of the legislature. And, you know, I can kind of talk down about the legislature sometimes, but fundamentally, I believe that that place does more good than bad sometimes. But, you know, there's this thing, right? It's like, hey, we know our constituents hate Trump. So what are we going to do? We're going to stick it to the man. We're going to do a resolution condemning Trump. We're going to try and censure him from the state level. We're going to do everything we can to, you know, aid the, you know, to aid immigrants in our community. Even if on a substantive level, we might not necessarily love the idea of aiding and abetting criminal undocumented aliens. But you know what? It's really good politics for now. the border wall. That's actually a moral stand, and I understand that. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, over and over and over again, these legislators are reading the same polls. Like, hey, let's do this. It's against Trump. This is more red meat for our constituents. Does that ring true to you at all?
To some degree, you're correct to put the border wall to a different.
Yeah, I think that's
because that is a moral stance. Obviously, yeah. You know, it's more symbolic on the issue of, voters are very supportive, not Republicans, but Democrats and independents. But so a net, well over positive like 60, like yeah. 60% support state and local governments, spending money to protect the rights of undocumented immigrants. And I think that has less to do with, stick it to Trump. And more to know that, most people in California know undocumented immigrants. They may be mowing their lawn. They may be cleaning their house. They may be a lawyer.
Yeah.
We have undocumented immigrant lawyers and doctors in this state. Yeah. And they're not all from south of the border.
Yeah, yeah. let me preface this conversation with I myself am an immigrant. Got my papers straightened out right before my 18th birthday, which is a huge blessing because if you turn 18 before you get them straightened out, the clock starts ticking again. Right. You go back to start, And I'm personally like dismayed. I feel like it's one of those things we're going to talk about polling today, and like we'll see, like on the death penalty issue. Mm-hmm. Say, well, you only get to ask one or two questions because you only have so much time, right?
Yeah.
And I think as a general statement, everyone, of course, like every reasonable person, I think is really, fair and respectful of immigrants in California. That's the general sentiment, right?
In California. It'd be a very different answer about state and local governments spending money to defend the legal rights of undocumented in Texas.
Yeah,
frankly.
Yeah.
But even though Texas has a very large,
I guess what I'm trying to get at is that oftentimes, like, who are the undocumented immigrants who find themselves sideways of ICE? Is this area of law that we call crimmigration. It's like you got sideways of the law, and now you're in ICE's crosshairs. I remember when I was working for Jimmy Gomez, we had this guy get deported when he was dropping his daughter off at school. And I was like, hey, you guys want to make hay about this? And they're like, no, because he was actually like wanted for murder or something. Right. So it was one of those things where it's like, yeah, if you ask just the top line of the poll, everyone's, of course, I support immigrants. Okay. Well, do you support immigrants who came here and killed somebody? No. Do you support immigrants who came here and have like 3 DUIs? No. Do you support immigrants? And so on and so on and so forth. Right. And so I think that people's, and for me as an immigrant myself, who I do acknowledge that I have like white skin, I can come off as white, and so there's perhaps some privilege in that. But I recognize that my community really struggled for everything that it got, And I really hate how like the legislature and like the liberal thought leaders are so obsessed with protecting immigrants who found themselves sideways of the law, when like That's like 3 to 4 or 5% of immigrants. That's not the rest of us. Don't lump us in with the rest of them. When Lorena Gonzalez had the bill about like, hey, you know what? It doesn't matter if you're undocumented, you can go ahead and practice law. That's the type of stuff that should be coming out of the legislature for immigrants. Not like, let's give you criminal defense money. I think if you came here and you fucked up, I don't really have sympathy for you.
Well, now I don't know where the state, I don't think the state is providing criminal defense money at all. It is doing things such as prohibiting the sharing of data, and the state has done that as has local governments.
We've set aside money for applications and stuff like that. I'm not sure criminal defense.
Through the University of California legal clinics, which UC Davis, I have to plug, has a great immigration clinic. But in the academic setting, yes, I think you're right on the serious, there's no difference in definition between the serious criminal alien and the ticky tack.
Yeah.
And that's one of the issues that we come down with. And that's not the only area where undocumented immigrants have gotten screwed kind of by law enforcement, frankly. They've gotten screwed by the DUI checkpoints. I put that in quotation marks, which probably looks really weird on camera. The DUI checkpoints, which are really driver's license checkpoints, where people don't have drive and they impound their vehicles and they make money.
Man, don't get me started on these public arms of the government acting like private businesses.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And then you had the situation in Los Angeles County. The new sheriff has stopped it, where they were pulling over every Latino going over grapevine.
Yeah, yeah. They pulled over some like three times more Latinos than they have in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's so funny because like I want.
We're just
like,
looking for drugs.
I so deeply want to move us along in this like post-racial fashion. Probably because I do have this white skin and I look white or I pass off as white. People are always like,
oh, and then you see the stupid shit that happens. Stupid shit
and I'm just like, fuck, okay, maybe we need some more, affirmative action. Maybe the pendulum hasn't swung all the way back. Yeah. You know? Because when I read shit like that, I'm like, come on, guys. In California, you didn't think you were going to get caught with this goofy bullshit? You didn't think it, you know?
Well, this comes down to a similar issue, which also deals with immigrants.
Yeah.
Right near where I live is the Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, the largest Catholic church in downtown, Latino Catholic, Spanish language Catholic church. And there's been food vendors around there for as long as anybody can remember. And about 2 years ago, the county health department came along and they didn't give them a citation and say, pack up your stuff and go home. They took all their shit.
Huh.
And basically, oh, no, you have to find a way. And many of these people don't have much transportation. You have to find your way to some city impound, get all your paperwork straightened out, make sure you have a sidewalk license, all of those things. Now, the state has stepped in to require most cities to have to allow sidewalk vending.
This is the Ricardo Lara thing,
right,
dude? Good for you, Ricardo Lara. Good for you. If you ever want to come on the show,
tamales and Mexican hot. I called them bacon wrapped hot dogs. I was corrected. No, they're just Mexican hot dogs. Get your shit straight, yeah. Scott.
Yeah. So you know, and this is why I think that we can't. You know, I'm always. Maybe this is just me being cynical, but I'm just like, these pollsters don't know anything. You know, I mean, this is my overarching worldview. Because you really do only have time to ask that one question. You know.
Well, like before we get to the death penalty, okay, let's dive into that. So the Public Policy Institute of California, with this regular Californians and government poll, they're asking what I believe is about a 45-minute poll. They give the data in the methodology. And they're asking over 1,100 adults. And the more questions you ask, the lower the response rates are. Particularly with cell phones, because now 70% of respondents are interviewed on cell phones. And all of us think about, you know, unlimited wireless, but some people still either think they're on permanent wireless or actually are still on permanent wireless. And so you have to be real mindful about how long the interview is.
Also just don't have 45 minutes.
Right. I mean, I make a pit stop before we record this, and like by the end of the hour, I'm like, gotta go. And my mom and I, when we have our, TMI, like I'll just say the many family conversations end with, I'm really sorry, but I've gotta go.
I mean, you don't have 45 minutes before noon.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, and my cell phone number is not in my voter registration. Well, actually, but PPIC uses random digit dialing, but I don't answer phone calls.
What's random digit dialing?
So instead of like buying the voter file and calling, they use all adults. So you could get a consumer database of all adults, or you could get a voter registration database. But the most accurate, comprehensive surveys are random digit dialing, where they know all the area codes, they know all the prefixes within each area code, and then it literally will be like 916-555-1234. 916-555-1235. Right. And then they ask the question, are you registered to vote? Are you sure you're registered to vote? And that's the criticism of their methodology, because they use all adults, and that would include undocumented, it wouldn't include underage, because they ask if you're over 18, but it would include non-voters. And you're asking somebody whether or not they are a voter and are likely to vote, instead of if they're buying data with our guest that I think we're going to have on after this show, Paul Mitchell. You know, he can tell you with almost 90% confidence who a likely voter actually is. So some polling, candidate polling, usually would use a commercial service like PDI so that they know for sure when they're polling that the sample is correct, instead of asking somebody, do you always vote? Well, shit. Yeah, I always go to church.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So PPIC is concerned about the number of questions. So, yes, you'd have to boil it down further. You also don't want to have a question that's too complicated. When you're asking all adults, starting out with, do you believe state and local governments should invest resources to defend undocumented immigrants? That's kind of like 9th, 10th grade level. And, you know, a lot of adults may not be, actually it's probably even above that, maybe 11th, 12th grade. And there are a lot of adults that aren't there. Yeah. But they're adults. Yeah. There are a lot of voters that probably aren't there either. So,
Well, you know, and you know what's interesting about that? Let me stop you right there. That doesn't mean they're not smart people.
No.
I think that when we hear that, it's like, man, most adults read at a seventh grade level, or most adults do this at a seventh grade level. You know, Floyd Mayweather can't read.
Yeah.
It was just never important to him.
Yeah.
It was just never important. He grew up like, you know, he's like, literally he like says like, I've never read a book. He can barely piece together like what he sees on the signs, but like he's functionally illiterate, but he's, I think he probably has some spending habits that are not good for long-term wealth building,
right.
But you know, there's also this little, he's not so little anymore. Well, he's small in stature. Nigel Houston, he's just like one of the greatest all-time skateboarders. I mean, he's like a phenomenal mind for skateboarding. You have to be able to like calculate stuff, vectors and whatnot. He's a smart guy, you know, to be able to skateboard at that high level. You know, his dad pulled him out of school at 11th, you know, when he was 11 years old. And he's like, you don't need high school. You don't need middle school. You're skateboarding for a living, you know? So, I think, you know, when you hear these things like, oh, you know, most Americans are at a seventh grade level and you're kind of like down on your fellow countrymen. It's like, no, most Americans just don't need that much more reading to get by.
Right, but we're talking only about the complexity in polling.
Yeah, fair.
Because,
so I was making
you know, the same issue, we don't have it on the outline, but February PPIC poll, they asked a question about split roll property taxes.
That's complex.
Having the assessed valuation increase for commercial industrial property taxes on actual market valuation instead of the 2% annual limit that applies to residential. Explain that in a poll question and explain what the benefit of the ballot measure that's qualified for November 2020 does as far as how it affects schools under Proposition 98 and how it goes out to local governments. You know, that is very complicated, a poll. And I've heard people from both sides tell me, oh, we've got solid polls. It's going to go to defeat or it's going to win.
So, but before we get into the substance of this poll, which I know you're dying to get to, no pun intended, sorry. Sorry, Paul. I know it's a serious issue for you guys, guys and gals. Let's talk about that. So when I was, I was actually one of these guys at Wells Fargo that would open up the fake accounts for you when I was in college. I was one of those, you know, personal bankers. It was like a dark tree. I just needed to get through college, you know?
Yeah.
But the sales training that they would put us through is features tell, benefits sell, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to tell somebody what the bottom line is. Like this, the benefit here is online banking will save you time. Would you like to save time on your banking? Right. I'll show you how. And then you get into all the features, right? But the features always come after the benefits. And it seems to me that like with a polling like that, and this is just my own gut reaction. I'm not educated in this. Again, I'm a martial artist by day, but this is just my gut reaction. Is the only real way to do that in a meaningful way is you'd have to say, you'd have to lead with the benefit of like, hey, would you like more funding for public education at the expense of business property tax? Something, because I mean, that's what it's going to be at the end of the day when the campaign gets going. It's going to be really simple messaging like that.
No. Well, no, if I'm business, I'm saying, do you want to push more businesses out of California?
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to happen.
No, but that's the argument. Now, the pro side's going to be, don't you want more money?
Right. But no refineries, which will be some of the biggest money against it. No refineries are going to move out of Benicia to go to Nevada.
Yeah, they got everything in the ground.
I mean, Benicia's already got a big enough problem going on with the black soot going up in the air and gas prices skyrocketing because of the refinery partial shutdown there.
I guess all I'm saying is that the poll language should more closely match the language that is going to get thrown around the campaign.
And I think PPIC is as neutral as possible on that compared to what I see from the private polling by campaigns. The problem is that PPIC... on these polls has to cover so many different subject areas that they don't have the time to actually dive deeply in it. Now, they do more subject-oriented polling, like Californians and the environment, and that's where you get into the weeds on some of these things.
Yeah.
So, you know, the poll that we saw, they support the governor's budget priorities, but by support, I mean above 50%. You don't have like 70% support for major initiatives in housing I'm trying to think. There's housing. There's another. What voters are kind of the least excited about is the $5 billion pay down of state and local pension obligations. With one-time funds, which is unfunded liability, which from a conservative sense makes complete
sense in the world. You have this excess money. Hey, let's put
it. But I think that people, I think the way the respondents heard it, the poll question was correct, but I think the respondents heard, do you want to put $5 billion or $5.8 billion more of one-time money more into pensions?
Well,
which is not the case.
No, but here's
we're paying off the credit card from a decade ago.
Well, here's a pushback though. It's like, do lay people feel like they're not getting anything out of that money?
Yeah.
Like maybe I'm okay with CalSTRS going insolvent because it doesn't affect my bottom line, and I'd love for you to fix the fucking roads that you just increase the gas tax. None of my commonly traveled routes have been fixed. I just want to say the 50 east, none of those potholes have been fixed. The giant pothole under the S curve has not been fixed. None of those commonly traveled routes have been fixed. At least mine.
So
I think some people might just feel like, you know what, I'm okay with these wards of the state just going, you know, just because it's, I don't think it's going to be there anyways in 100 years. And you want that $5 billion of my tax revenue? I'm not going to get anything for it. No, put it into my kid's school. I think that's what people are feeling.
Of that $5.8 billion, $2 billion is going to fund, to buy down the CalSTRS, the Teachers Retirement System unfunded obligation.
Yeah.
That actually is directly freeing up local school district money, because on the natural, local school districts and community college districts would be paying about 2% more in local pension obligations next year under the CalSTRS kind of long-term obligation fix. And under the governor's proposal, it'll only be about 1%. So that's 1% more of payroll for every school district in freed up money. And that's an ongoing free up, if you will. So that's significant. And it was a real smart move by the governor, because he checks off two things. Checks off giving local school districts more money, and he gets some of the debt off the state's balance sheet.
Yeah, that is smart.
So,
what else do we have in the poll?
They generally are supportive of the governor's plan to shorten the high-speed rail ambitions, which I like Governor Newsom. Any voter that knows what the governor's plan of shortening the high-speed rail ambitions are is beyond anybody in Sacramento, because we know that the plan is, it's like, okay, we're going to build just from Merced to Bakersfield, and we're going to plan for the rest, and we're going to look for more money. I don't think that there's a concrete plan per se. Another issue that the voters are generally supportive of is the governor's plan to go from two water tunnels that ferry water underneath the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta, which is where the water from Northern California flushes into the San Francisco Bay. The Governor Brown had proposed two tunnels to go under the Delta to feed into the California Water Project, the aqueduct that everybody sees when they drive down I-5, to go to mostly to LA. It's not real. I mean, Central Valley Farms get a little bit, but that's really not their main source of water. So it's really about meeting Los Angeles water needs, which frees up water for San Diego. It's part of the issue of how do we solve the problem with the Colorado River, where we're in negotiations with four other states about sharing water, and don't even get us down that rabbit hole.
But it's also Delta sustainability and where you're doing the pumping and kind of getting it further upstream away from the Delta smelt, and just kind of being more ecologically sensitive throughout the whole process. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of political chatter about water running off into the sea in California. Well, that's nature in California. I mean, long before there were humans in California, the water was coming out of the mountains and going through the San Francisco Bay Delta out into the Pacific Ocean. And it's an important ecosystem. Yeah,
you know what? I give the Democrats a lot of shit on here. Let me give the Republicans some shit. You guys are morons. Okay. The guys who are talking about like, oh, let's play with water flow going out underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. If that salinity comes in, you're not getting it out.
Right.
If that even in the drought, people like all these Republican talking heads, especially back east, right? It's like, oh, California's wasting all this water on water flow, getting it out under the Golden Gate Bridge. No, you fucking dummies. We're trying to make sure the salt doesn't come in and fuck up farming for everybody. It's right. So important to keep that salinity out.
And right? You could talk to a lot of conservative fishermen in Northern California that run salmon operations because it stops the salmon flow, which has been a long time concern in California. And then we're ending up with marine mammals coming up our rivers.
Yeah.
We have seals coming up in the American River. There were two gray whales.
Last summer, I saw a big old seal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there were two gray whales, I want to say, that were in the Los Angeles River.
Oh my goodness.
Over in the last few days here. Yeah. So, I mean, there are some significant issues here.
I think the people who say that are just looking for a talking point to rally up their base with. Like, that's not a serious proposal. It's like, you have to let some water flow out. You have to, right?
Yeah. And there will be. And I think that the single tunnel is sort of the compromise with the environmental groups that will, along with additional storage with the site's reservoir, which has already been approved at the state level but is awaiting federal funds, we've got our big solutions kind of in front of us. And I think that there's a willingness of the environmentalists to say, okay, let's do that and then hold
no
off.
More.
Yeah. Now, if you believe that, you know, check back in a decade.
Hey, so the single tunnel, the appeal of that is what it's just less ecologically it's just less damaging to the environment. It's just less capacity, lower flow.
Yeah, lower flow. So more flow would go into the Delta.
Okay, and this is presumably better for the people in the Delta as well because it's less disruptive to their operations.
I don't know that because
they're probably still against
what
it,
people
right?
Like, probably don't understand is this Delta that we're talking about. Before you even get to what people would kind of think of the Delta, you know, as you're, you know, going over the bridges, the Benicia Bridge, you know, you've got all these little islands down in San Joaquin County, southern Sacramento County, and these islands are farming islands. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very foreign concept to people that there are farming islands in Northern California, like, and they're reliant, reliant on this water, and this water not being too not having too high of salinity.
Yeah.
So your point on that is very important. I mean, you have the issue of the actual fish population, but how do the farmers in the Delta access fresh water?
Yeah. And for folks listening across the state, man, take a trip up to the Sacramento River Delta area. Juisties. It's if you're wearing a hat, you can put it up on the ceiling and just kind of leave it there. It's like fresh seafood, halibut, fish. It's Portuguese, and you get a garbanzo bean soup with every, you know, everything you order is like a 4-course meal, you know? And then you can drive back and hit the sugar mill on the way back.
Yeah.
Or just do like some, you know, get some coffee and drive on these levees, so you're overlooking the water.
What's the old hotel there, a big venue?
I went to
a lot of weddings and stuff.
Yeah, in Locke, right? Or Walnut Grove Mansion or something
like
that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's further out in the Delta, but anyway, we digress. Our 4-hour, what a week.
Hey, so it's so funny that you talked about there's not necessarily a lot of voter support. I mean, there's lukewarm support for the housing initiative, like, you know, above 50%, lukewarm support for the housing priority. Nonetheless, that same poll, I think, said 9 out of 10 voters.
It's a big problem.
It's a big problem, but they don't want to spend money in this way. Why do you think that is? Because I have my own thoughts. But.
I think that they don't see the state's role in doing it. They see it as a private enterprise, and there's a lot of truth to that, although the state does...
What do you think?
Well, the state does provide grants to local governments to subsidize affordable housing, and affordable housing subsidies is usually... breaks for developers that are building below market rent properties. And to the extent we tackle that issue, we do two things. We can partially address the homelessness issue, although there's a big mental health and addiction problem that has to be addressed with many of those folks first. But you have the homelessness issue, but you also, if you have subsidized housing for people that are eligible, you may be freeing up market rate housing for other people. And that may bring down the market rates.
Yeah, it might or it might not. Yeah,
it's a quandary.
Yeah. Going back to the homelessness thing, you know, when I was working for Tony, she always had this big thing. It's like housing first.
Senator Atkins.
Yeah, Senator Atkins. Hey, man, I don't.
I'm just know. For our listeners, yeah, for our so listeners. Who may not know Tony. Yeah. You think you worked for Tony Thurmond?
Yeah, that's fair. You know, she always had this like big push. Early, she always had this like, hey, housing first. You know, if you're not sober, you know, you're still a child of God. Why don't you come on in out of the rain and. You know, and actually, you know, you save some money that way too, right? Because what does a modest little unit cost you? Not that much per year.
Certainly, a lot cheaper than an emergency room.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think that when you get into like the housing first discussion is so interesting because a lot of people are just like, no, they have to get sober first. You know, like right, you run into these sort of.
It just takes more services. Yeah. But again, it's cheaper than the combined other services. Once you say, you know, a fire department run, a paramedic run in Sacramento is like $1,600. God, can you imagine? That's before you even get them to the emergency room where they're sitting to just get what we call a banana bag, you know, just the basic nutrients to get the system back up and running and keep them away from their drug of choice.
That's before they look around and say, hey, this is pretty good. I'll stay for 3 days.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have to consider all of those costs. And I think that
it's just cheaper. Yeah.
And I was watching some hearings on this over the past week. And I heard it from members on both sides of the understanding that we have some real problems. There was a great discussion in the Assembly Health Committee. There are three members, two Democrats and one Republican, that are former emergency medical technicians. And the issue was creating some sort of referral network whereby an emergency room could immediately find out where a bed for somebody with addiction
or somewhere might
right where something's available instead of keeping them in an emergency room bed. And this could actually be for a first responder before the person's even taken to an emergency room.
Yeah.
And there was like wide agreement of it.
In theory,
You know, there were questions because it was, I think the hospitals weren't crazy about it. Because the onus was going to be on them.
They're going to make a new requirement, you know? Yeah. I was having heart palpitations last year. And it turns out, you know, we never really quite figured out what it was. Their best guess is I was eating spicy food and I was getting like heartburn that spread to my lungs. And I thought it was in my heart because I'm just a panicky individual. But let me tell you, I'm okay, guys. So you guys can look forward to a few more decades of me. But anyways, I went to the emergency room a couple times because I was really scared, you know? And let me tell you, man. For you to ask the people working in that emergency room to do one more thing is cruel. Mm-hmm. You know, you got like one poor nurse like holding it together, like the whole, you know, you got a guy urinating off in, seriously, you had a guy like urinating himself, just soiling himself off in the back corner. And before you know it, the janitor comes in. I come in with the heart palpitation, so I got to skip the line, of course.
Right.
You know, then you got someone with like a broken arm, kind of like this. You got another guy with a like his bowels are really hurting and moving, and he's just like dying, keeled over like this. You got another guy that's just asleep, and they're just trying to move people in and out. And you know, so I think it is kind of cruel to have to ask those folks to do another thing. But at the same time, it's like, hey, maybe if you can do just this much more, you can have such a great benefit to society. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I don't envy the work that these legislators have to do because those are tough, tough questions.
They're very difficult, much more difficult than the talking points that we see initially. And watching these hearings is actually very, very interesting. For those that listen to us and don't watch the legislative hearings all the time,
I know. Oh, dude, Cal Channel.
Many of you have to. But calchannel.com, and then on most of the cable providers, you can watch it on the California Channel. And just watching a hearing and watching what seems to be a simple issue turn into something much more complex and seeing how the groups line up. This is, you know, we talked before about the dialysis bill and the strange alliances that come aboard on that issue. Insurance premium rates, that was a debate over the last week or so, where you get labor and the health plans, no, I don't know. It was like, it was strange. It was like,
it's like odd bedfellows.
Yeah. It was like labor, health access, which largely is labor, and some of the providers, all in alignment. And then the insurance companies, no, we can't do that. Yeah. Although they're required to do it for like if they're under the exchange. Mm-hmm. So it had to do with those plans that were being negotiated on behalf of large groups, such as organized labor groups, you mm-hmm. know, or entities that are under organized labor that are not going through the exchange, where you have printed, publicly printed insurance rates for, you know, everybody. Mm-hmm. The Kaiser lobbyist was saying that, you know, it used to be so simple. It was like for over 65, it was this fixed rate. If it was under 65, it was for that fixed rate. Gotcha. It's a lot different now because we have much more of a risk assessment situation.
The actuaries have done their work.
Yeah, and we have computers. I mean, you know, some of these things come from before computers, and now, you know, they know everything about you. They know your perfect blood chemistry. They've probably done 23andMe on you before you've done it.
You know, in a way, it's kind of, yeah. In a way, it's probably better under the old model. It's like, hey, everyone pays this much, whether, you know, like, if you're sick, you're still a child of God. You know, it, like, if you got diabetes, are you not still a children of an expanded
On my walk universe? Over here, yeah. I saw a lot of people, because it's such a beautiful day outside. Yeah. I saw a lot of people riding those damn scooters and riding the jump bikes. They weren't wearing helmets. I usually wear a helmet when I'm riding my jump bike.
Yeah.
Anybody could be hit by a car riding one of those damn things and end up like, in the ICU tomorrow.
I actually like that idea. Because it's like, you know, the risk assessment is just like, oh, well, you know, risk assessment is just a way of shifting affordability onto people that can't afford it. Right.
I mean,
just make everyone pay the same.
A brain injury from riding a scooter without a helmet and being an idiot, as I saw some people doing today, that's going to cost a lot more than my friends that have diabetes and have seen the insulin costs skyrocket.
Yeah. Hey, let me go back to this housing thing. I think you hit the nail on the head, and I want to talk about this. And eventually, we should. I'd like to have a housing expert, someone who can really talk through this redevelopment and this affordable housing movement that the state is concocting, because that doesn't seem like a real solution. Like, I remember in San Diego, we had this affordable housing project for, I don't know, it was maybe 100 units, you know. And then Voice of San Diego, who does some great investigatory work down there, did the math. I'll have to look it up, but they did the math and like, hey, every one of these affordable units is going to wind up being like $1.2 million, you know, and it's only 100 units. You know, so doing like this big decade long project for 100 units in San Diego is like me giving you a penny for lunch.
Right.
Like that's just a drop in the bucket.
Right.
You know, like don't talk to me about multiplying effects and we get the 100 neediest, but you just did 100 people. There's tens of thousands of people feeling the market forces of housing affordability, squeezing out all their disposable income. Right. Well, and so you, I guess what I'm saying is like the state of California is kind of like the administrative bureaucrats dream of a perfectly administered state. So, okay, here's this huge societal problem. Here's my administered solution. That's just not right. The real forces of housing affordability are permitting, zoning, you know, environmental reform, and opportunity hoarding. Neighbors want to keep people out of their neighborhoods.
And guess where that's happening right now is on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, right near the ferry building. There's, I believe, 140 units that have been proposed of. I believe it's affordable housing, not a shelter, but affordable housing. And the neighbors are the ones that are leading it, and they're threatening a ballot measure to block it. Right. And they've got the executive director of Delancey Street saying, this is bad. You're going to have people with addictions living near.
It's so funny, in San Francisco.
Near Delancey Street, because we're the great. And I love Delancey Street's model. They've been great. I love their restaurant, but come on, you know. And it's
share
no matter
dream.
Where
share
you want to do it.
Your neighbor.
We've had it in Sacramento just over the last couple of weeks. You know, proposal on off Broadway, and then one out at near Cal Expo off Ethan Way.
Yeah,
you know. So I mean, city governments are moving forward on it, but the NIMBY spirit is alive and well in California, even when they answer polls saying, oh my God, housing's a crisis.
Yeah. You know,
I'm in my $2 million house or condo, tiny condo in San Francisco. That's like a single room shared bath condo in San Francisco. It's a huge crisis. Affordable housing? What are you talking about? You're gonna, how dare you?
By me?
Help the homeless? I gave that homeless a quarter the other day.
Yeah.
I bought him a cup of coffee.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Charles Murray talks about this a lot in his book, mm-hmm. Coming Apart, which is, I'd recommend to anybody. It's kind of like this. I mean, he wrote it 10 years ago, and he really predicted a lot of the sociological phenomena that we're talking about today, where people are just self-sorting, you know? Actually, he blames colleges a lot for that, because like people who went to college marry each other, and people who didn't go to college marry each other. And so the big sorting machine begins, you know. But, you know, people want to cluster into these enclaves.
That's why you have to buy your kids into the best college.
That's why you have to buy your kids. You know, let me riff.
You spend that kind of money. They're going to meet somebody else that spent that kind of money.
Let me riff on this for a second, because we were driving back from Tahoe yesterday. We went up to Tahoe for Cesar Chavez Park. And it used to be that the boundary line for the Folsom Community Plan, I think, was the 50. Hmm. And everything south of the 50 was just open space. You remember how I like to talk about, I like to go to Michigan Bar Road, Jackson Highway, that whole area is pristine. It's untouched. Those beautiful rolling foothills from the Folsom Granite Bay, from Folsom to El Dorado Hills, this lush green, you know, pasture land. They jumped the 50. Hmm. They're building sprawling housing, more housing tracks down, you know, south of the 50. Why? Because the people north of the 50 are like, what? You want to build more housing by me?
Right.
You know, these fucking property holders think they're kings, you know. Share the American dream. We are all children of an expanding universe. We're all here for each other, with each other. I mean, I get it. It's not something you want to do. It's like, oh, I'm gonna have 100 new neighbors and, you know, traffic's gonna be worse. But it's either that or endless sprawl. The societal problems will compound, you know. And like, really, at the end of the day, what really is gonna affect you? You know, if you get some new neighbors.
Well, and the last thing we need is more traffic on Highway 50.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, Senator Weiner, Scott Weiner from San Francisco, is really onto something on the transit-oriented housing, having higher density housing, stimulating that.
Let me tell you something.
Within cities.
You're going to have to get the riffraff off the public transit before people like my wife ride the metro. My wife's not getting on BART in San Francisco, okay? Because she can't defend herself. She can't defend herself. You know, she's concerned about stepping on a hypodermic needle. So I totally agree with transit-oriented housing, but you're going to have some real security solutions. And like, you're going to have some sort of mechanism to maintain the basic social contract that people who can't defend themselves physically feel safe going on to the, mm-hmm. going on to public transit. I feel like
that's where tying the transportation dollars to the housing element makes some sense.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the state should step in and provide, using gas tax dollars, step in and provide greater subsidies for public transit so that you could have more security without having more security and having skyrocketing fares.
Yeah.
And then you have riffraff, as you call them, skipping the fares.
Oh, I don't give a shit about skipping the fares, man. Just don't take a shit in the subway, man. Just don't take a shit in the car. Just don't come on with your boombox and sing and dance and stuff in a menacing manner. If you want to do it in a celebration of joy, of life, do, you know, of course. But
I've seen some really good musicians.
Yeah, no, I'm cool with that. But don't come on and, you know, don't come on repping your set and menacing everybody on the train. You know, like that's really, really makes people not want to ride the train. You know, anyways, what else do we have here? Death penalty. This was a big one this was kind of like its own bullet point we had here.
This was a headline story that came out of the poll. And
again, we're talking about the PPIC poll. If you don't, are they on Twitter? Do they put these out on Twitter?
It will just go to PPIC.org.
Okay, PPIC.org.
And it's right there. If it's not on the homepage, just go under topics, statewide survey, and you'll see Californians and state government. And it's a wonderful read. They provide both what we call top line, so an easy to read one of all adults, and then you can also find their cross tabs where if you're a geek, that's where you can see where, you know, how men feel, how women feel, how the Bay Area feels, etc., on each topic. So the death penalty, again, the question was simply. You can't say simply and death penalty in the same sense.
Well, I don't know.
Question is, for first-degree murder, do you support the death penalty or do you support life without the possibility of parole? That was the only question that was asked, and it was similar to the question that they've asked in the past since 2000. So we have a trend line that we've been able to follow. The PPIC found among all adults that 31% support the death penalty still for first-degree murder, 62% support life without the possibility of parole. That is a shift from what we saw in 2000, where it was 49% supported the death penalty. So from 49 to 31 now over the last 19 years. And those that supported life without the possibility of parole, it went from 47% to 62% now. So there has been a major rethinking among all adults. And you see it also, although not as significant, among likely voters. And I think it's for two reasons. One, you've had a demographic shift in California. California is more progressive than it was. Progressive, liberal, whatever term you want. I don't want to offend anybody. Yeah. But they lean more that way than they did in the year 2000. And certainly if you go back to 1990, it would be even more dramatic. PPIC wasn't conducting this poll. I don't think PPIC was around 1990. But so you've seen this shift. I think it's demographics, and also we've seen the emergence and the wide usage of DNA evidence and these stories of exoneration, that there are people that may have been naturally inclined to support the death penalty, that hear read one story about somebody that was on death row who's exonerated because of DNA evidence, and they just flip the switch and they said, if you can ensure that they're going to be locked up forever. And I don't know of any death penalty, any death row inmate that's escaped San Quentin, then their voters are just fine with just lock them up forever and don't kill them just in case we find that DNA evidence later on.
You know, what's funny is like the locking them up forever is actually cheaper than the death penalty.
And it's a legal system. Yeah. It's a legal system.
But you know, what's interesting though, is that like the DNA evidence that has been found, hasn't a lot of it been found because of the appeals process that is necessary because of the death penalty?
Yep.
So if they were just run-of-the-mill life, you know, LWOPs, life without parole,
yep,
folks, they probably wouldn't have had all these safeguards and redundancies built into their cases.
That's true.
They probably just would have been left to languish.
And so, it's the appeals process, both from having more resources and, you know, lawyers to look at it over time, but also the technology has advanced so much over the time. I mean, the case that was cited, or the case that was heard decided this week, in which it was unanimous, it was upholding the death penalty, but it's a guy that's been on death row for 21 years.
Oh my God.
And in this case, so let's jumping back to what we've talked about before. So the question that PPIC asked was, after Governor Newsom had announced his moratorium on the death penalty. Again, the moratorium is a reprieve of the individual 737 cases. It's neither a commutation of the sentence, saying it's no longer first degree murder with extenuating circumstances. It's either first degree murder or manslaughter of some sort, where the death penalty wouldn't be an acceptable penalty under California law. It was neither a commutation or a pardon, which is the excuse, the crime didn't happen.
Right.
Which there, as I noted in the Nooner, some of the people involved with President Trump are looking for right now.
I'll bet.
Paul Manafort wants, I don't think he's going to get it, but George Papadopoulos, who was the coffee fetcher, may get it. But
savage.
So what happened was, so he issued the moratorium. PPIC was already in the field. That's what we talk about when they're interviewing people. It takes 9 days to conduct a full PPIC poll. So they were conducting a poll from March 10th to March 19th. Yeah, March 10th, March 19th. I guess that's 10 days. And it was March 13th was when Gavin Newsom announced this moratorium. And they scrambled and they said, we've got to ask this question. Nobody was expecting this moratorium to be issued. And they're asking like, okay, they're asking about like micro issues on different housing and all these things. And it's like, we're missing one of the biggest political issues this year. So they added this single question on beginning on March 13th. So about from what I can tell, about 65% of the overall poll response were asked the question that yielded the result that I mentioned of 31% supporting the death penalty, 62% supporting life without the possibility of parole. Now, also, so that was on, so that was March 13th, and then on, was it Wednesday of the, what a week, I don't know what day it was, but some damn day this week, there was a decision upholding the death sentence of a guy that's been in death row for 21 years. The issue was not the constitutionality of the death penalty. So it wasn't testing the fairness of the death penalty, which is one of the issues that Gavin Newsom has laid out. He says it's fundamentally unfair based on access to legal services, you know, proven discrepancies based on ethnicity, that sort of thing, race and ethnicity, that sort of thing. Well, Justice Liu, Goodwin Liu, former Berkeley law professor.
Former Obama appointee, right?
He was an Obama appointee.
He got fucked.
But he got fucked. Yeah, he got fucked. So he was working, I think, for the Obama administration.
Hey,
he was
appointed fight,
to the Ninth Circuit, I think. And he was blocked.
That's not a bad place to end up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's California Supreme Court.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant guy. And so Goodwin Liu wrote a concurrence opinion supporting Gavin Newsom's actions and backing it up with legal citations. He was joined in that by Mario Florentino Cuellar, a former Stanford law professor. Both of those two were appointed by Jerry Brown, and they both said, the governor is right here, you know, in this moratorium, because it's proven that we've got these major flaws with the death penalty that go beyond the issue that we had before, which was the method of death penalty.
You know what kills me about this whole thing? That was just the word I was going to use, but
that's gallows humor.
Also funny, the moratorium on the whole thing. Yeah. No, but you know what really grinds my gears or gets my goat about this whole thing? You know, we'll go back to this whole thing about the DNA evidence, and we'll use that as a departure point, right? It's like, they only found this DNA evidence because of the extra safeguards built into the, the extra safeguards built into the death row process, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if they, you know, when anti-death penalty people, you know, in their laundry list of, you know, of talking points, they're like, just lock them up and throw away the key. That's worse. That's just as bad. That should, you know, serve your appetite for retribution. And like, yeah, it is worse, actually. And if we're going to have all these layers of appeal and due process and due diligence for you know, pulling the trigger on somebody and ending their life, we should have something like that for life without possibility of parole.
Well, because, and I think it would naturally shift over.
No, but that's functionally killing somebody, is to lock them up and throw away the key for life without possibility of parole. And so when Governor Newsom, you know, gets on his high horse, and Goodwin Liu and all these other liberal Democrats get on their high horse and say, well, not in my name, don't kill in my name, you know, it's fundamentally flawed, and say nothing else about the fundamental flaws of the criminal justice system in California generally. No, let me just stop there, because this is what appeals to my base of voters. Never mind the fact that we're, you know, locking up and throwing away the key on, you know, tens of thousands of black and brown, primarily young men, every year. No, we'll just stop here, because this is the issue that appeals to my coastal corridor, you know, Davis, Berkeley, San Francisco, Sacramento, LA constituency. We don't have to do anything about that same analogy that they just made, access to services, fundamental unfairness. Why wouldn't you just have the political courage to just take that one step further? No, that's not good politics for me.
Well, so
I don't like that.
The main effort on the death penalty. Yeah, you are.
No. Okay.
Batshit. Certifiable. Lock him up.
Why not take that argument and go a step further and say there's fundamental flaws
I would proffer that the resources that are currently being put on the capital appeals, the death penalty appeals, would shift over in that case. And there's a lot of money is spent on non-capital appeals, life without the possibility of parole, the legal clinics that you have in the law schools. And like you have, so Innocence Project is the biggest effort on death penalty. I think those resources would shift over and there still would be avenues. Most people that are life without the possibility of parole, they're not seeking any further, legal service
remedies.
I mean, so is it because they've given up or they're just like, yeah, I fucking did it. I don't know. But I think that those that have a true claim, if they went over to life without the possibility of parole, and those that are currently on reprieve will still have the support from, you know, the pro bono legal community, a variety of other programs. And I don't know if the state has an office of the state public defender, and I believe it only does capital punishments right now. I think those resources would also shift over. How you would triage, if once you add the former death row population to the general population of life without the possibility of parole, I don't know how resources would be triaged. That would be the biggest question.
Got it. Going back just quickly on this thing, again, you only have time for that top line question with that death row thing. And so it shows 31% support, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I just took this off the internet, okay? But like at every point that the California voters have had to repeal the death penalty or to vote against it, they've actually upheld it, haven't they?
Right, but I just told you about the shift in attitudes in over the last 19 years.
Yeah, but I
mean, the last one was 2016. That was when, and we talked about it in a previous episode, in 2016, when the voters were asked to pull that provision, Section 27 of Article 1 of the California Constitution, and voters said no. So I don't think they're there yet. And I still, if I was a political advisor, and I think I've hinted at it in my writing, if I was a political advisor to Democrats, I would say, don't try and seek it yet. You don't want to be smacked down in 2020. When you've seen such a trend away from support of death penalty, you have Gavin Newsom most likely until 2026. Mm-hmm. You're going to have no executions until then. And voter attitudes toward the death penalty will probably continue to erode over that time.
This is kind of what you and I were talking about last time too.
Yeah.
Just let it, you have your preferred policy outcome, let it rest.
Right.
For a while, for 8 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why? Yeah. Okay, here we go. You wrote this down. I only saw this a few here and there. Federal Judge Roger Benitez ruling on the gun magazine limit approved in Prop 63.
I'm glad you said the Latino name right this time. Yeah. I think when you did the rundown, you were a little bit off, but not that I don't pronounce words right, names right. This, well, you, the reason you just saw it is it happened at like 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon.
Let me tell you, my...
Yes, Gibran. I fuck up your name every time.
my Twitter and Facebook echo chamber on the conservative side is going nuts on this thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
explain it to me because I'm not actually even sure what it is. I just see people going nuts. And I kind of want to know more.
So there are a couple of major points. So the United States Supreme Court spoke on the Second Amendment was in the case of Heller versus the District of Columbia, where the District of Columbia had tried to ban handguns completely and require rifles and shotguns to either be disassembled or and unloaded, or if they were loaded, to have a trigger lock. And the United States Supreme Court said reasonable gun regulations and gun ownership regulations are acceptable at the federal, state, and local level. However, there is an individual right to bear arms for lawful purposes, including the protection of your own home. And so California's legislature passed a law, 2000, I want to say, that said that you couldn't manufacture in California magazines, ammunition magazines of over 10 rounds going forward, and you couldn't buy or own new ones in California, whether they're manufactured here or elsewhere, that were over 10 rounds on a going forward basis. In 2016, there was a ballot measure put on by the legislature that was Proposition 63 that coincidentally passed but with a 63.1% of the vote. Easy one to remember. And what it said was that ban on owning a magazine of over 10 rounds would be retroactive. And you had to either turn it over to law enforcement, sell it to a dealer who then presumably could sell it out of state
or destroy it.
And gun owner, not Gun Owners of America, they were the Heller versus District of Columbia plaintiff. A gun rights group sued in California against Prop 63 and said that it violated the the premise of Heller versus District of Columbia. And so yesterday, Roger Benitez, in a federal district court judge appointed by George W. Bush in San Diego, ruled that indeed Proposition 63's retroactive prohibition of owning magazines over 10 rounds was in violation of Heller versus District of Columbia. And he issued that as a summary judgment. There's some major issues right there, which is if he's ruling that the retroactive, which is the only thing that was challenged in this case, mm-hmm. the retroactive prohibition on magazines over 10 rounds is prohibited, then why would it be allowable on a going forward basis? If you're finding it under Heller versus District of Columbia as an unreasonable gun restriction, then it would make no sense whether it was retroactive or on a going forward basis.
Oh, interesting.
So this is a federal district court judge. Now, what we know is the Ninth Circuit, we have Court of Appeal at the state level, Court of Appeals at the federal level. Makes sense of that. Mm-hmm. But the Ninth Circuit, which is parodied frequently by President Trump, is a fairly left-leaning bench. Why? Because it's Hawaii, California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. So Alaska's like, wait, uh-huh. we're still here. we can see Russia. So the question for Attorney General Becerra, who is the defendant in the case, because this, remember, Proposition 63 was approved by the voters. So any time a ballot measure is approved by the voters, the defendant is the Attorney General. Yeah. Now, we've had cases where Attorney Generals have kind of said,
No thanks.
Yeah. But in this case, he has been defending it. So the question for him is, do we take it to the Ninth Circuit, where we have a pretty good chance? And I think that under Heller, I was reading the case this morning, both the case and the opinion, summary judgment opinion by Judge Benitez, I think that there's a pretty good chance the Ninth Circuit would overturn the district court ruling in this case. The problem is you could be opening the door to review by the United States Supreme Court, which again, right. So right now we're only talking about this retroactive issue. We still have the going forward ban on manufacturing and possession of the magazines.
Yeah. You want to let the Supreme Court get a hold of that?
So, right. And that could open the door to a lot more issues under Heller.
Everyone go ahead. They're going to issue a banana clip to every person with a new decision.
Yeah. Now, the strange coincidence about this is so this was yesterday. This ruling was handed on Friday afternoon. We're recording this on Saturday. On Thursday, the United States Supreme Court refused to block a preliminary injunction granted in the district court. I don't remember which district court it is, but it's in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And a district court did not grant a preliminary injunction against the Trump administration's ban of bump stocks. Do you remember what bump stocks are?
Yeah, it's like the little, like, you can just take the stock off and put it right back in, right, with like a little button.
Yeah, I think of it like a big rubber band that turns a semi-automatic rifle into a quasi-automatic rifle.
That's the Vegas shooter.
It was what was used in the awful situation at the concert.
Yeah, could
Vegas.
We say that Trump has done more for gun protection than Obama ever did?
I'd have to go back and look at the record, but that was very significant that the Trump administration actually. So now NRA gave him a blessing on it though too.
Yeah.
Well, that's the NRA is like, okay, we're okay with this one, just to keep, give you something you can say.
That's about white culture.
Yeah.
That's cultural. That's not, this is my whole thing about politics being about culture and not about policy.
Yeah.
That's a cultural, like, hey, you know what? You're our guy. It's okay. But, I would love to see, like, some of Trump policies, like, just like, hey, are you for this? Just like they did with, like, the AC, with the Affordable Care Act. Hey, are you for this? Are you for this? Are you for this? Oh, actually, I am. I am for that. I am for this. People are like, hey, holy shit, that was a Trump initiative, you dummy. If you're going to hate Trump, and I'm really no fan of Trump, if you're going to hate him rationally. He's right about Space Force. I know. I sound crazy. He's right about Space Force.
I just don't see why it's a why it has to be a sixth part of our armed
Neil
forces.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has this whole, like, two-hour talk on it.
Didn't he? He's in trouble himself.
He is in trouble himself. Okay. He's right about the NATO fair share issue. he's right about those, you know.
Right.
People will say like, oh, you know, Trump is weakening NATO. You know what weakened NATO is? The whole alliance never paying its fair share for the defense of its own borders. That's what weakened NATO is, you know, 3 decades of people never ponying.
Well, Europe is kind of a banana republic right now anyway.
Yeah.
Now, I love Europe, but I'm just watching this Brexit shit. And I'm like all confused.
That's crazy. You know, but and talk about the liberals welching. You know, this should just be a hard crash at this point. Yeah. You didn't get your way. You didn't get your way, and you can't put. If I was a Brexiteer, I'm not. But if I was a Brexiteer, I would be lighting the streets on fire. It's time to leave. You didn't get your way. You're not going to get a negotiated solution. Politically, there is no possible viable negotiated solution if you look at the math of where the members of parliament stand. So it's just going to be a hard break. You might as well just tear the rubber band off. To do a referendum, I think, would be to just take that whole half of the country and say, you know what, you don't matter. Really dismayed. Like,
and
either we have a democracy or we don't. And now I guess we don't have a democracy when the deep state establishment doesn't get what it wants.
And it's all awful. Of a sudden we have a big border conflict with Northern Ireland again.
Yeah.
I mean, you start unraveling all the elements of the skins of the onion.
So what did you take from this bump stock aside from this magazine ban?
So basically, the Supreme Court did not want to reopen Heller at this point.
Yeah.
So on the bump stock issue, which
on
now
the magazine issue.
They were getting right on. No, on the bump stock issue.
Okay.
That was what they.
That's right. That was Thursday.
Right, that's what you're saying. And that was a. There were no dissenters on it. There's no comment on it. It just basically said, we're not taking this up. It was passed on by Sonia Sotomayor, which was her obligation, because the justices share, they each have assigned courts of appeals districts.
Got it.
And so they basically, without explanation, said, we're not going to hear this issue. So it actually goes back to the district court, because there's never actually been a finding on the issue. It was no preliminary injunction, so the plaintiffs, Gun Owners of America, immediately went to the Sixth Circuit. They didn't overturn the lack of preliminary injunction, so then Gun Owners of America went to the Supreme Court because this ban is going to affect right away. I think it's actually, the date may have been this week.
Yeah.
And so they tried to fast track it, and you know, the courts agreed to fast track it up.
Yeah, it's the Gun Owners of America. That's the group.
Yeah.
They're throwing around some really great memes online, actually, because they're protesting the stuff that the NRA won't.
Right.
And so they're putting themselves out online, like on Instagram, as like the real OG like gun rights people.
Yeah.
And like
they're the
NRA is too soft.
They're the militia. They're the militia.
They are the militia. Folks.
I mean, They're the rights to hide out in cabins and, you know, like you have your own country in your cabin, you know.
Oh, the volunteerist people.
Yeah.
And the sovereign citizens.
Right.
Yeah,
the militiamen on the border, you know. I mean, it's
yeah.
So that one's going back to district court. But I did read something into the Supreme Court not stepping in and saying, we'll look at this right away. Or there's a preliminary injunction. You have to have a likelihood to prevail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's looked at. You have to show in your pleading that you have a likelihood of prevailing. And none of the courts found that they did under the Heller principles, last echoed by the Supreme Court, or last found by the Supreme Court. So I don't know what the Supreme Court would do on a capacity limit.
Yeah.
And it's important to go back to the federal judge, Roger Benitez's ruling. He specifically cited 3 cases where women were home alone and they had 10 round capacity clips and they ran out of ammunition and actually they were really bad shots, but I can't say, you know,
you know what, man, dude, have you ever been shooting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a bad shot.
It's tough, man. With pistols, it's really tough.
Yeah.
The San Diego sheriff took us out. He invited us to his range. And they had this thing that, because it's on a rack, right? So they can slide it back. And so they put it 6 feet away from us with like a little short barrel pistol. And they did this game with us. And so there was like a blue circle, orange triangle, and a red square. And inside of each one, there was like numbers 1, 2, or 3. And so you'd either they'd call out 1 and you'd have to find it, or they'd call out square and you'd have to find it, right? Mm-hmm. And they'd say, and then try and do it as quickly as you can. And so you have these like preconditions in your head, right? So you call out, you know, number two, and then you're looking for number two, and you're also matching it with the colors, and then you try to do the shot.
Yeah.
Dude, I didn't get one on the paper.
Right.
I didn't get one, you know? And then they had one, I think they had one of their deputies do it, if I remember correctly, and he was just like, bam, 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 you know? So it's hard, man. I really could see wanting to have, you know, if Haley's home alone, I want her to have a fucking banana clip, you know? Like, why wouldn't you? I don't know. I don't have guns. I'm not super yeah. like zealous.
I grew up with guns, yeah. And we have a family ranch in Texas, and I've shot guns. A very rustic family ranch at my grandfather's place, a hunting ranch.
Oh, cool.
And you know, I've shot guns that aren't allowed in California, you know, but in a very safe. I mean, my family is always very safe as to like when the kids were allowed to first shoot and like,
yeah.
and like. You were like, you couldn't even go out hunting if you like aim, you know, if you swung your gun around the wrong, it'd be like, you're on probation for a day or two.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, so I don't know, 10, I don't know about that limit. I don't know what limits are acceptable. I do believe that under Heller and I, you know, that individuals have a right to gun ownership, but there are, you know, reasonable regulations. Bump stock.
I feel like if you want
the question of magazines is a good question.
I feel like if you want to kill people, you're going to find a way to do it. You know, I mean, now they're talking knife bans in Europe.
Yeah,
you know, and so I hate the way that the liberals do this. Like when people say like, well, so far as other folks have guns, I want one too.
It was scissors in Jordan Peele's Us, which I saw yesterday. It was scissors.
It's gnarly. Yeah. But, you know, like, I hate people when people say, like, you know, insofar as there are going to be guns out there, I want one, too.
I'm not a spoiler because it's in the commercials. You see the scissors, so.
Yeah. I just feel like if people are going to have guns, I would like one, too. Or I don't even have one, but I really do feel like guns don't kill people. Like, people kill people, you know? Every one of these mass shooters was on antipsychotics and antidepressants. Why isn't that ever brought up? Because it's not good red meat for the base. You know, I think we have like a huge mental health problem in this country, and we don't really need to infringe on my wife's, you know, ability to protect herself. You know, I saw this really pleasing video on Facebook. It was like women gunning down male assailants, and that makes all the sense in the world. This is, you know, among other things, this is the ability of women to protect themselves. If they need 12 shots, they need 12. I don't care. You know, I fundamentally don't care. We have some special elections on Tuesday. Senate District.
And let's not forget to come back to the PG&E issue.
Oh, did we skip? Should we just, let's just go right into that. Let's go right into that.
So
Newsom said we don't have an energy crisis. We have a PG&E crisis. Did he say something
like that? Well, what happened, what a week. So earlier this week, it came out some of the major debt owners, the note holders, not the debtor in possession. Okay, we're getting a bankruptcy law. So debtor in possession is the cabal of bankers that have lent about over $5.6 billion to PG&E to continue operations while in bankruptcy. That's a common stance. But then you have the traditional debt holders, which are those that have, you know, bought bonds over the years, or these big, you know, hedge funds, etc. Well, they were floating a plan on Wall Street and in the Capitol of how PG&E can exit bankruptcy. They were pledging to give PG&E money, which is giving a haircut. Yeah. The debtors in possession would be paid off, and there would be an unspecified amount of state-issued bonds.
Unspecified.
And what that means is those would be, in order for those bonds to be sold on the market with PG&E's junk status credit rating, that would require a rate increase among PG&E rate holders approved by the Public Utilities Commission.
They want the state to co-sign for them.
And that's, they want, right. Well, and this is using that SB 901 authority that they got on August 31st of last year. Yeah. 2 months before the campfire broke out. So that SB 901 authority was just talking about the 2017 fires, which now PG&E has been exculpated from. And now they're saying, okay, well, we need SB 901 to be changed so that there could be a new rate allowance to pay off debt from the 2018 crisis.
Good luck getting everybody to take a vote on
that. So the state can borrow money, because PG&E is not going to be able to borrow money and get both the legislature and the PUC to approve these essentially rate hikes on everybody, man, including all PG&E. So
it's a good thing they're papering everybody.
Right. People in Davis are PG&E electric. We're PG&E gas here, so I don't think we would pay an increase. We're just paying it for San Bruno. Yeah. But there's some big shit, because the legislature feels like they were lied to last year.
Hey, members,
year.
We're going to need you to pony up for one more bailout.
Yeah.
Take one more political hit for us, please, pretty please.
And
it's a good thing they're giving so much money to the Democratic Party, isn't it?
Well, PG&E's not. It's the electrical workers, which is the important thing to remember, that labor, the electrical workers, and management of PG&E, and in this case, all these financiers, they're all in it together.
They're in it together.
And on the other side,
because the electrical workers fear that they're going to lose their jobs if this, they kind of want everything in stasis, like, hey,
and they don't want to. They don't want a state utility.
Yeah,
and that's the fight we're seeing in San Francisco.
Wouldn't that be better for them?
Do you want to negotiate your contract in a smoke-filled room behind closed doors? Or do you want to have it in a public hearing?
In the legislature, yeah. Okay, fair.
I mean, those are some pretty good contracts there.
Got it.
They don't really want them to be seen the light of day. They don't want the SACB to have everybody's salaries. Like, you can look up every state employee by name, look up their salaries. The labor folks don't want that.
Yeah, okay, fair.
So, so you get these very strange bedfellows, and it's going to be a big fight. But what Gavin did on Thursday, I think it was he wrote a letter to the interim CEO of PG&E. So the CEO, right before they filed for bankruptcy, left town with a golden parachute.
These guys.
And this was a woman. This is a Latina woman that they got.
Of course.
And it was like the face of PG&E.
Diversity.
And like,
you're being fleeced by a diverse cast of characters.
Right. One of the top Latina CEOs. She may have been the top CEO in America. And
I remember
there's
a big celebration about her, right?
Yeah.
You're being fucked by a diverse cast of characters. Us corporate Democrats are fucking you, from Latinas, Latinos, gay, straight. They're all fucking you.
So as part of this, they call them term sheets of, okay, this is how we're, how we're proposing the financing to exit bankruptcy. So the term sheet also included, oh, by the way, we, the hedge funds, are basically going to appoint the new PG&E board, which is going to appoint the new CEO of PG&E. And Gavin Newsom said, bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could...
You know, this is good politics.
If you could have a full paragraph of bullshit, that was what Gavin said.
This is good politics. I feel like this has been like the Jerry Hill playbook for like the last 8 years, too. It's like, hey, just rail against you. No one likes their utility.
Right.
No one likes I certainly don't like paying the bill. That's my only interaction with them.
Right.
I don't see them as this big community institution.
I see them digging up the streets. They're the ones fucking the streets that we have to pay for.
Lawmakers like to act like their utilities are big community institutions, mostly because they're in cahoots with them. But, I feel like rank and file citizens don't see utilities as like partners in reducing climate change. It's just good politics to push back against the unpopular utility.
But they're really good at
paying. And it's also good policy, too, in this case, I think.
And they're really good at the utilities are really good at paying off local community organizations through sponsorships, including,
Hope.
In particular,
the whole Hope thing is bullshit. Right.
Yeah, minority chambers of commerce. If you look at the SB 901 analysis, and I've written about this, there's all of these minority chambers of commerce and community organizations that have no policy analysts whatsoever.
Let me talk about that. That's part of why I quit my job at Imprenta Communications, who's hiring, by the way, perpetually. Are they?
No, not
okay,
right
good, now. Okay, good, because I'm going to fuck them. Well, no, but they're always hiring because it's a bad place to work, but they were hired
by... How do you really feel?
Yeah, they're always hiring. When I was there, the 4 months that I was there, they had like 90% turnover in their staff. It's run by fucking morons who don't know what they're doing, and it's just a bad place to work. Don't work there. Anyways,
Sponsoring next week is...
No, Joe Zago is actually really cool. I really enjoy Joe Zago. He's not the problem. He's the guy here in Sacramento. Okay. He's a really great guy. But... community sponsorships thing. Part of what they do, this is part of what we were doing at Imprenta, was helping these minority chambers of commerce throw a racial monkey wrench into this like discussion about dollars and cents and, you know, who's going to wind up paying the bill. You know, it's like, wait, they, like, basically, like, part of what we do is like, hey, we'll help you turn this into a racial issue.
And it happened twice last year. It was SB 901.
Dirty. It's so dirty.
It was a wildfire, the PG&E bailout, and it was against net neutrality.
Net neutrality. Do they think we're that stupid? Like, oh, the Black Chamber of Commerce is against it, so this must be a racial issue. Well, or maybe, just maybe, they were paid off by PG&E.
There's this little African-American museum in Los Angeles that it's not even a physical museum at this point. It's like a moving exhibit. And I'm sure that they've got great work, but they appeared on both of those analyses against net neutrality and in favor of the PG&E bailout. They don't even have any staff from what I can tell.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure they get sponsorships or will get sponsorships, but I really want lawmakers to like call bullshit on some of these committee analyses. And they said, so PG&E bill, I want to say was amended on August 29th or August 30th. And I think it was August 29th. And
it's just so gross to use a racial card on this thing too.
August 30th, the floor analysis said on support and opposition, verified August 30th. Bullshit. I call bullshit. I know how busy those legislative staff are the last week of session.
You can't verify.
You can't verify, particularly these organizations that don't have staff. They said, they called up a lobbyist. They said, is this list of 27 people still on board? Oh, yeah. They hadn't read the amended bill. Yeah. Most lawmakers hadn't read the bill, which they were pissed off about when they found out
a couple of days.
Right. You know, 2 months later, when the fires broke out, 2 days after the election, they're like, what? Yeah. We were lied to.
No, the only difference between corporate Democrats and Republicans is that corporate Democrats celebrate diversity. That's it. They're functionally the same. You know, it's a plutocratic society we have across the street over here.
Special elections.
You know, you talk to us about this. You're more suited for this. I don't even know who these folks are. You say here, watch for IEs.
Right.
It's happening on Tuesday. So who's going to come in at the last minute?
No, this was this past Tuesday. Okay. We had special elections in Northeast California. This is from all the way up to the Oregon border, starting in like Roseville.
I saw a daily sign actually come to think of
it. Yeah. Yeah. On Highway 50, you'd see it. Yeah. So it's a very large district, maybe the largest geographic, either that or one down southern in the San Bernardino County. And the two that emerged from Tuesday's special election was Assembly members Brian Dolly, former Assembly Republican leader, and Assembly member Kevin Kiley. Kevin Kiley's from down here in the Roseville area.
And Dolly's from
Oroville, that area. Well, in the primary election on Tuesday, March 26th, Dolly had a huge independent expenditure campaign behind him with the Realtors, California Professional Firefighters, and the California Correctional Peace Officers Association all together. Huh. I think it was just because he's kind of like, he's a nice guy. People like him and they've known him longer. Kylie's a freshman. He just came off his first term.
So he's more of an unknown quantity.
He's more of a known quantity. The strange thing to me was that they didn't get behind Rex Heim. Rex Heim is a longtime business guy, lobbyist. Yeah. Reagan, I mean, he's been around forever. Pete Wilson came up and did a fundraiser for him. His last gig was the California Business Properties Association, which is like the anti-split role organization, you know. Yeah. But everybody likes him. He was the president of the California Aggie Alumni Association.
Oh, fun.
He's a lobbyist that would wear a Hawaiian shirt to session, to a budget hearing or something. But you had all of this money spent behind Dolly in the primary, and I think you're going to see it again in the general, which will be June 4th. Although Kylie is sitting on more campaign money of his own. So
where's he getting his money from?
He raised it during the first term. He like raised over $500,000. I mean, he actually had quite a nest egg. I haven't really dove into that one.
How does a young first term Republican assembly member build up such a nest egg?
I don't know. Okay. That's a good question. I'll look into that. Okay. Some may be his own.
Is he a baller?
He's business partners in a cattle ranch now with former Congressman Doug Osi, who represented he represented from Yolo County and then he moved out to East. That's now mostly Ami Bera territory.
Got it.
And then down in Southern California, in Long Beach, we had the special.
This is what you're talking about, the oil money coming into play in Long Beach. Talk to us about that.
So for the SD1, the NorCal one, that's to fill Ted Gaines' seat, former state senator. He's now on the Board of Equalization.
Okay.
Southern California, Long Beach. This is for Ricardo Lara's seat, who's now the insurance commissioner.
Senate District
33. So we had 12 candidates in that race, two Republicans and 10 Democrats. Eight Latino Democrats, one Middle Eastern Democrat, I think, Abe Saleh, and an African-American, Al Austin III, who pulled out, but was still on the ballot. But Lena Gonzalez received over 30% of the vote. The next highest Democrat was around 10%. The who she will be facing on June 4th in the runoff is CPA Jack Guerrero, a Republican. The interesting thing about Lena Gonzalez is that the oil and gas industry has spent over $1 million, most of which appears to have come from Chevron. That it's hard to say exactly because it's an ongoing committee and most of their money was carryover from last year, but Chevron's the only one that came in with big money in 2019. And you think
to help her or to hurt her?
To help Lena Gonzalez specifically. And they've already spent money for digital ads for the June 4th runoff election. So they're still behind
her. So she's an oil corporate Democrat.
She can point to...
She just is. I mean...
Well, she can point to votes on city council where she was anti-styrofoam, a couple of those things.
Right. But when it comes to oil, it's very clear.
When it comes to oil severance tax, it's very clear. And frankly, as a Long Beach City Council member, oil severance tax is a very big issue.
Yeah.
And people don't think about oil. They think about oil production in California. We've talked about this before. They think about Bakersfield. They see all the rigs down there. I grew up in Placentia around. We had oil rigs like right in our neighborhoods.
Yeah.
There's a lot of oil in Southern California. Just is not the mass that you see in Oildale outside of Bakersfield. But in Long Beach, you have right offshore, you have the Tidelands oil revenue. If you're ever, they put them in these kind of interesting structures. Somebody actually posted a picture of one today. They were sitting on the beach. And you see these, they're sky blue structures to hide the fact that they're oil rigs.
Oh, interesting.
And they're Tidelands oils rigs, and the city of Long Beach gets revenue from them.
Hmm.
So you have the port traffic, which is not really affected by oil and gas severance tax because that's imported oil. As opposed, whereas the oil and gas severance will be
pumped out of the ground
only here. Pumped out within the state's territory. But still, Chevron has interests in both. California and imported. That ties into labor, obviously, the longshoremen. So you can see why a Democrat that you might say, well, you expect all Democrats to stand in line and on the New Green Deal type of mentality of let's raise taxes on oil and gas.
Those are my guys on the shore.
But there's a lot of Democratic interest. We can kind of tie this back to the PG&E issue of PG&E and labor, you know, and a Democrat kind of has the same
interest rubric, isn't
it? Whereas you may naturally think, a Democrat's going to be anti-corporate.
No.
Doesn't work that way. And their jobs in your district.
You might think that, you know, a decade ago, but it's just not the case.
Yeah.
All right, we're running out of time here. We're at actually an hour and 15 minutes. 2026.
I got to go get my ribs in the oven, so we got to hurry up. Okay.
At the SAC Press Club, all these people who will never be governor said they want to be governor.
I wouldn't hold that.
Yee.
Are you saying a woman's never going to be governor of California?
I think more likely than any of these is Tony Atkins.
That's a possibility. We don't know where Tony's going to go.
Yeah.
That's a good question. We haven't. But what happened was Eleni Kunalakis, who's the lieutenant governor, Fiona Ma, and Betty Yee. Fiona's the treasurer. Betty is the controller.
Yeah.
They were all speaking.
I take that back on Eleni Kunalakis. She's a real darling of the progressive Democrats. Yeah. At least here in town.
I think she's got
real potential.
Yeah. She's got business community and the progressive community.
My little echo sphere on social media is like head over heels for her. So I,
yeah,
you know, and I do like what I've seen from her. Yeah. I shouldn't be so gruff.
And Fiona's got real.
What does Fiona have?
She's got real strength in the Democratic Party. Fair. She's a trenches person.
Yeah.
Eleni kind of came out of nowhere because she was in Hungary as an ambassador. So she had to be kind of sold to the progressives. $10 million from her dad kind of helped with that. But I personally like Eleni, and I think she's doing a good job. And I'm really happy that she and Gavin have formed a partnership.
Yeah.
And she's basically in charge of, you know, bringing international business to California. So I'm all for that, as opposed to just ignoring Lieutenant Governor.
Makes perfect sense given her previous role.
Right. So they were at this press club luncheon, and the question was, are any of you interested in running for governor when Gavin Newsom's out in 2020, presumably out in 2026? And I believe Betty went up and said, I'm in right away.
Oh, cool. Good for her.
And then Fiona said, yes, me too. And like Eleni, yeah, me too. Okay. So they all basically indicated they're interested in running for 2026, and it's never too soon to start, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Lorena set out her marker for Secretary of State very early too. You know, it seems like that just seems to be there's no disincentive to do that.
Well, and what are your consultants telling you?
Yeah.
I mean, consultants want permanent campaigns, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that makes sense.
The operation, it's like, and
hey, let's just keep this thing churning.
And right. From a strategy perspective, it's the same thing. My friend, Pete Aguilar, congressman from Redlands, you know, I get emails like every day from him asking for money. Gave him money when he first won. I haven't given money since. I don't give money anymore because
Pete,
I do this full
stop
time.
Sending
like,
him emails.
Pete, you're fine.
Don't you know Scott sends you emails?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Hey,
he does get the Nooner. So
Devin Nunes.
Oh.
Is he going to win? Does he have a shot in hell of winning this lawsuit?
I don't think so.
Is this kind of like when Matt DeBovna sent us a cease and desist letter?
Exactly.
We said that he allegedly exposed himself to
drop trowel. Yeah. Allegedly.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely a real piece of shit.
The Assembly's independent lawyers said it was more likely than not that he did drop trowel.
Yeah, we'll post the letter too on Twitter for folks who want to
Devin Nunes has been plagued by parody Twitter accounts. The first one was Devin Nunes's mom. So it was Devin Nunes's mom. And so if you don't know Devin Nunes, he's from Tulare County, which is south of here.
It's actually one of the poorest counties in America.
It is. So that's
He has better things to be worried about.
It's just to the east of the now TJ Cox seat, a little bit to the northeast of Kevin McCarthy's seat in Bakersfield. But it's dairy country.
Yeah,
and
Turlock,
he's
right?
A dairy. Yeah, Turlock. Visalia.
Portuguese
Visalia. Yeah. And so he is a dairy farmer. So the first parody account was Devin Nunes' mom. And some of these are parody accounts and some are just people changing the names on their existing accounts. So when you see Devin Nunes's, you know, cow's baby, you know, I mean, we're getting like generations now of these accounts. There are dozens. I can't keep track of them. So there were a few of them that just started beating him up like crazy about Russian connections. If you may remember, Devin Nunes was involved with the House Intelligence Committee, investigation.
Some information for the president.
And so he kind of got removed from that oversight when the Republicans still had the House. But anyway, so he got really frustrated over these parody Twitter accounts, and he sued Twitter $250 million for not blocking these parody accounts. And this goes on to the same issue of the accusations that Twitter and Facebook are in cabal with the Democrats, which there isn't much evidence. Do they lean Democrat? Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan are big donors to the split roll tax.
I think you could probably say this. If you look like person for person at their hires on their policy teams, they come from the cultural left. They come from a protective like let's create a protective environment that's less likely to hurt people's feelings as opposed to hey, free speech is free speech, right? They just come from the cultural left, and that's okay. I mean, look where they are. They're in Menlo Park. They're in the Bay Area, right?
Their employees are. They're young. Yeah, it just makes, I mean, demographically.
Yeah.
Their policy employees.
People are probably liberal guys and gals, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the conservatives are probably onto something, you know. Whether there's still private companies that can do whatever they want.
Well, I don't think so. I think that they're being accused of not blocking these accounts. But the problem is once you start blocking, you have to block equally.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's legitimate in discovery to ask, okay, which accounts have you blocked in the last year?
Yeah.
And then the other side can say, you blocked all these conservative accounts and we have this proof that you didn't block these liberal accounts.
Joe Rogan has an excellent 3-hour breakdown with the CEO of Twitter and this investigative journalist called Tim Pool, mm-hmm. where they're just going through block by block. Mm-hmm. And you can come out of that talk and be like, wow, there probably is a problem.
Honestly. Well, and this isn't Devin's Congressman Nunez, his first foray in a conflict with media, quasi-media. He's been in a battle with the Fresno Bee for years.
That doesn't make sense.
And they just went back and forth throughout the entire 2018 cycle.
Isn't it kind of good for him to create a national platform to be like the one Republican who's sticking it to Twitter?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of good. That's a good contrast for him, right?
Like particularly in his district. Yeah. I mean, Andrew Jantz, who ran against him, who ran a very good campaign, raised all this money. He's now said he's not going to
rematch. That's not a good fight for him.
Rematch. In that district, man, they don't fucking use Twitter. They don't know about Devin Nunez's cow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's shit that we laugh at around here that maybe people in the Bay Area do, but it's not going to drive any votes in Congressional District 22.
No, but it's a good national fight for him to pick. To elevate him as a leader in the conservative thought. You know?
I think so. Might get him on some talk shows.
All right, brother. This has been what a week for March 30th. Okay, we got to wrap it up.
Okay, thanks, sounds brother. Good. I got my spare ribs in the oven.
That wasn't so bad.
No.
Oh man. Do you want to just send me the text for the classifieds and I can read them? So I gotta
go. Shit, that's right.
So I gotta go.
Oh, it's on the